Today is Sunday, July 18th, 2021. This is part 18 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart. Last name spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Tom. I'm doing great. I hope you're doing the same.
Very good. Thank you so much for asking. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, sir. Please go ahead.
Awesome. Thank you. In part 17, I had a wonderful journey with you as you took me around the Powell Plateau with Art Christensen. That was a great backpack, and that was in the spring of 2003. So I'm just like eager to know, what did you do in the fall of 2003?
Yeah, that's right. In the fall, in October, late October, actually, we had a plan to go down and traverse, Art and I, that is, had planned to go down into Crystal and follow the Tonto around Scorpion Ridge and into Monadnock Amphitheater and then drop down to the Bass Chenamo drainage and then eventually come out Flint Creek drainage to Point Sublime. And we were hoping to climb Fan Island while we were down there. So that was the trip we had hoped to do. But when we got to the North Rim, we had we ran into the rangers there and in the area of the basin. And they basically said, well, there's fire out here and the road's closed. So you guys can't drive to the west anymore, any farther. And here's an example, Tom, where if we'd had a permit for this hike, you know, it would have been all fine and dandy until we got there, and then if, you know, then the permit would be useless, right? And so anyways, we kind of did some fast thinking on our feet here, and I said, well, why don't we try, and since we're in this area here, why don't we try and go out and climb Shiva Temple and Claude Birdseye?
Okay.
Out on the Teal Point Road, right?
Okay.
So we could drive in as far as that road. That's where they closed.
Okay.
That's where they closed it in the basin there. The road to the west was closed, and then you could drive to the Teal Point Road, which itself had been closed years earlier.
Right.
When they expanded the wilderness, right?
Right.
And so, but we could park right there at the where the Teal Point Road cut off from the Point Sublime Road in the basin.
Okay.
So yeah, so we parked our car there, Arts and Preza, and you know, put in a fair stack of water because it was still pretty warm. I remember that, and we put a fair amount of water in our packs because this was expected to be, you know, dry the whole distance.
Right.
So. And then we walked south on the Teal Point Road, and it's just a beautiful walk through the forest there, probably about five miles, something like that total.
That's trees down on the road there?
Yeah, I don't remember that per se, but there was a fair amount of wind, and trees were an issue the next couple of days. Mm. As I mentioned to you, so we actually headed south on the road, and it's all very easy walking. And then we figured out where to cut off the road and head to the southwest to get to the next drainage that leads you down to the Shiva Saddle, the drainage and ridge.
Right.
So Teal Point is about it's a very prominent point that sticks out to the southwest and faces down onto Shiva, but there's no access off the point. And that's where the dirt road goes to, trail nowadays. So we had to cut off and head to the southwest to find the break.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'd been down this this break before, Art and myself, when we climbed Ra, Tower of Ra with Barb Zinn in 1970. I have to go back to my notes for that, but
okay.
It had been quite a few years earlier. So... it was nothing new, but of course, after 20 years, you kind of forget a lot of these details.
And, right.
And But nonetheless, I do recall here, and I've refreshed myself as well looking at my notes, that there's just like, you know, really nice walking down through this break, you know, off the rim, dropping through the Kaibab, and then eventually the Torweep and Coconino, like with lots of deer trails and easy to find your way, but not obvious, you know. And at mm-hmm. that time, it'd just be like these deer trails would just be a few inches wide and but flat, you know, and you know just definitely a way to go and passable and but you'd have to wander around and sometimes try to link them up and find your way through the occasional cliffs and whatnot. So just a lot of fun to get down to the Shiva saddle there, and that's where we set up for the night. We had found a campsite there pretty much in the, you know, we got close to dark by the time we got there, and so we set up for the night, and I had in my notes here that because there was the fire, right, there was a lot of smoke in the canyon, and so it was kind of limiting our views. And for some reason, I don't know if it was that smoke or what, but I had like the best sleep that I'd had in many, many a year, right, in that saddle. Huh. And I usually sleep pretty good in the canyon. So, it was pretty, for some reason, it just kind of things clicked, right? So we got up in the morning. It was a pretty warm time. And we threw our water in our day packs, and the idea was to try and get out to Claude Birdseye by the top by using Shiva Temple, right? So we started up, and, you know, you've probably been up Shiva yourself.
Right.
But it's a, you know, very historical kind of ascent.
Yes.
Because of the National Geographic expedition that went up there in, I believe, 1923. And
that Kolb had been up there before them.
That's right. And, you know, this received a lot of publicity at the time because the biologists thought there might be, you know, unique and independent faunas that had evolved on the Shiva Temple, you know, that would be like lost species that had evolved independently. And it all turned out to be just hogwash, of course, biologically, but mm-hmm. it was still mm-hmm. a neat little expedition. And I was kind of surprised at the complexity of the route up through the Coconino.
Yes.
And I guess when the was it the New York Museum and with the Smithsonian, I'm not sure which museum it was that undertook the expedition.
Right, I have to go look, check my notes.
But yeah, anyways, when they had gone in there, they brought along a lot of mountaineering gear and expecting a challenging climb, and you know, I mean, you have to be astute, and you have to poke around and find the right route. But it's a third class scramble,
right?
But it's very complex. You know, you have to kind of link back and forth, and there were a number of cairns that we saw that we, you know, went and followed, and it turns out that they didn't go anywhere. So a lot of people, you know, have, I guess over the years, tried this climb and different ways up it. But once you find the route, it's pretty straightforward. And, you know, essentially deer can run this. I think that deer can manage this, not too much problem. But they certainly can come up other sides of Shiva. So, mm-hmm. It's certainly not anything unique from a biological problem. But it was great to get up on top. And, of course, we found the old camp debris. There wasn't too much of it. There was a table that we found there, a folding table. And Art told me that he had talked to Harvey or heard from Harvey, maybe reading something that he had said, that Harvey had said he thought that when he'd been up there, he'd found this table, and he thought it might have been for skinning animals. That's what their plan was. You know, if they found anything unique up there, they would capture it and then skin it and then bring that back for museum storage and whatnot. But there was that, and there was these big milk cans, which everybody
right.
comments on when they get up there. And there was a cairn inside, not a cairn, but a register inside one of the milk cans. So we added our name to that. There weren't too many people who had signed that. But a couple of guys had been up there a couple weeks before us. And so we had seen some tracks on the way in, and we figured that people had been in the area recently. But presumably these two guys, you know. And Tomasi had – had signed it. So I think
This
that might
was
have been,
Pernell Tomasi or Aaron?
I think it was Aaron.
Okay.
I think this was one of the first times I'd come across his name in a register. So that would have been around 2003. Of course, he was picking up his climbing at that time
Right.
and doing a lot of climbing. I'm not sure how many things he's done, but must be way up there in the high, well over 100. And we had just had a great time there, and then we decided that we part of this trip we wanted to maybe go and if we had the time to go and climb Isis, which is a big Coconino temple to the southeast of Shiva. So we went along the east side of the Shiva temple rim, the east rim of it, and to the point at the southeast end where we could look down across to Isis, and it was very smoky because of the fires.
Oh, right.
But we didn't know the details of the route up Isis at that time. So we're kind of thinking that it must, that it would be there would likely be a route through the Supai at the north end of Isis, somewhere on the northwest face or the northeast face. And we were scoping this out with the binoculars, and it did not look good at all. And as we all know now, the standard route is at the south end.
Right.
So the standard route to get through the lower Supai is at the south end. So it was interesting to get this perspective and to see that it was going to be a challenge. And I think because of the heat and the smoke, we just decided that we wouldn't do ISIS as part of that trip. We would do it later, right? But we still wanted to get and to try and get out to Claude Bird's Eye. So we then hiked back north along the east rim, and then just before we got back to the northeast point where the route comes up from the saddle, we headed west. And I was really surprised because there's these two valleys, two small little valleys on the top of Shiva that drain to the southwest. And when you're walking, when you come up onto Shiva from the saddle and all along the east rim of it, down to the southeast point where we had our view down to Isis, it's all pinyon juniper, right? I mean, it's nice. It's nice forest. But it's open with the sunlight between the pinyon junipers. But then when you go to the west, you get into these two small valleys. They're parallel valleys, and that drain to the southwest. And just back from the north rim of Shiva, you get this beautiful ponderosa pine forest in there. It's just like magical because it's like this little pocket, of ponderosa pine that's surrounded by all this pinyon juniper and a totally different, forest dynamic in these two little valleys. So it was just kind of surprising to find this on top. To me, I didn't expect to see it. I thought it was going to be all pinyon juniper. So
Yeah.
yeah, anyways, we followed these drainages down, and the more northerly one, more westerly of the two, is the one that we actually went down to the lip of the first cliff of Kaibab that we came to. And we had to work our way down through the cliffs, but there was a way to get through this drainage to get down to the base of the Kaibab. And then from there we followed the Kaibab around and Torowi over to the ridge that's west of that's at the west end of Shiva. And from here we could see down to Claude Bird's Eye Point. So we it was fairly close at hand, and we knew that it wasn't too far away, and we shouldn't have too many challenges, I guess, getting over to it. But it was a grunt, and that part of it was because of the heat, and the southern exposure, and part of it was our route finding, because on the way back we found a much more straightforward route coming more or less straight up the ridge. And I think there was some that going down and going out to Claude Bird's Eye, there were some drops that we probably didn't negotiate in the right place. And if we'd done a little bit more technical climbing, we could have done a more direct route, right?
I
But
see.
you don't necessarily see that when you're coming down from above,
Not at
right?
all.
You see that on the way back.
Right.
So, yeah. So we got out to the point there, Claude Bird's Eye Point, and named after the cartographer, right? And we didn't know where the route would go, but we found some gullies in the Torweep, and Art just started running up these gullies and chimneys, and quite honestly, it was pretty impressive. I've seen articles in Arizona Highways or some, I believe it was Arizona Highways, where people went out there and climbed this with a rope, and Art just scrambled up everything without a rope. But he did have a rope. It was just over his shoulder because we had brought a rope, thinking that we might need it, right? Mm. And so he got to the top of the second pitch, essentially, and offered me the rope, and I said, "Sure, I'll take it." So yeah, so he just brought me up that short little chimney pitch to get up to the top, and I think that was my 70th summit.
Okay.
At that point, Claude Birdseye. So that was pretty. Pretty satisfying, you know. And but we didn't spend much time on the summit because we had a long way to go to get back to our camp in the saddle. And again, it was kind of warm. So, but from the summit of Claude Birdseye, we could look at the west end of Shiva, and it looked like there was probably a break that we could negotiate directly up to the rim at the west southwest end of Shiva,
right?
Rather than traversing along the south face of Shiva to get into those gullies and drainages that are kind of more in the middle of the central part of the temple. So we thought we'd give that a shot, and plus that was going to be in the shade too, so which was kind of nice. And so we headed that way, and again the return over up the ridge through the Torweep cliffs and Coconino was pretty straightforward. And we made better time. But then fortunately we got into this gully, Kaibab Gully, at the west end of Shiva. And again, with route finding, we pieced together the deer trails and back and forth, and eventually we were on top. So it was pretty satisfying. And we had a nice walk along the top of the temple there, and then found our way back down the climb up to the saddle. And, so we camped at the saddle, and again, we're still thinking that maybe we might try Isis. I guess we actually didn't decide to turn back on Isis until the next morning, because we did try to walk to the south and find a descent. I had come up from Phantom Canyon in the mid-70s all the way to the rim. But I, you know, coming up from below again, it's a different story, and you can see the route. And we didn't know exactly where that route went, so we kind of were poking around and losing time. And eventually, we realized we just don't have the time here to tackle ISIS at all. And, you know, in retrospect, knowing now what I know about ISIS, it was a very feeble attempt. You know, we would have been vastly short of our destination, particularly with the amount of water that we were carrying. So anyways, we turned around at that point and we said, well, let's just head back to the vehicle and we can find some other things to do. And we'd already been talking about the Colonnade, which is another Coconino summit to the actually I think it's Torweep, come to think of it, but it's another summit, another temple to the east of Teo Point. Across the Phantom Creek drainage. So we reversed our route back to our camp there in the saddle, packed everything up, and then headed back up the road and got to the car and went into town. I think we had a shower there. That's kind of a common thing to do in the North Rim village. And we called Bruce and told him of our change of plans because he was, you know, keeping tabs for us. He was our security.
Okay.
We didn't talk to the Park Service because we didn't really have any necessity to do that. And our next trip, the Colonnade, was just going to be a day trip. So we cleaned up and relaxed, and then drove our vehicle out and parked it at the parking lot for the Woodfirst Point Trail. And that's just very, very close to the village and not very far away. And we parked there, and then we ditched into the woods just a short distance. We hiked up the trail a little ways to where you get kind of onto the ridge the higher part of the ridge there, and the wind was just really roaring, and I know we were a little apprehensive about camping up there because you also don't know what's going to come down, you know, in the middle of the night. But we did that. We didn't have any choice. Because it was pretty late in the day, and so we just found a place to put up Art's tent, and we were fine. We had no problems during the night with trees coming down, but we did hear a few, and that was kind of unnerving, you know, to think that trees are coming down and they could potentially come down on you. So,
right.
But everything was fine. Everything was fine. And the next morning, it was another great exercise in route finding. Again, we're walking the Widfirth Point Trail. And it's just another North Rim hiking experience. It's just gorgeous hiking through the aspens and the firs and the ponderosa as you get farther south. And navigation on the North Rim is usually pretty straightforward if you know how to follow a compass and you can read a map.
Right.
And so it's just always a lot of fun to plot your route. And you'll find that you say, well, we have to go down this ridge. There's probably going to be some bumps on the ridge, high points here and there. We got to make sure we cross the high points. We don't want to have the topography dropping off too much to one side or the other, you know. And you just keep that all in your mind, and it just becomes a really elegant walk through the woods, which is this one is, right? To get out to the point overlooking the colonnade. And we did get a false start. I remember that. And we kind of went a little bit past where we should have turned off the Widfirth Point Trail. But we realized quickly that trail was starting to drop too much, and we needed to go back and then drop off it and head to the southwest earlier on, which we did. So we eventually found our way to the rim. And again, it's just kind of analogous with the route off the rim to the west of Teal Point. You know, there's deer trails at the rim, and you just kind of piece things together. You're working your way through a few little cliffs, and you get yourself down into the Coconino. And at the Coconino, it's all these tilted slabs of sandstone, and it's a little unnerving. And then you realize that the best way to go is just straight down the ridge. It's steep, but you go down this ridge and hanging on to trees here and there, and it's very straightforward to get down to the saddle at the colonnade north rim juncture there. And so we rested there, and because again the heat was kind of tough for us, and then we started up the climb. And right from the beginning, right, actually when we were coming down the ridge to the saddle, we could see into a gully on the colonnade, and we could see an obvious cairn there. So we thought, well, that must be the route up the colonnade, and we headed for that cairn. It wasn't very far, a few tens of meters from the saddle. You could see this gully, and I remember looking up at that cairn, thinking, my gosh, this is steep, you know. So I headed up that, and it was pretty dicey, this north facing gully. And I remember at one point I was hanging onto a redbud tree, and there was all this duff that was falling out from behind the tree, and I was wondering if it was going to pop out. And I eventually made the couple of moves to get up onto this ledge above this redbud tree to where this cairn was, and I was kind of beat, you know, tired from that effort. It was more than I expected, and it had been a little unnerving too. And then I looked right around the corner on this little ledge, and I could see this very steep but sloping ramp that looked like it went all the way down to the base of the cliff. So I told Art, look, don't bother coming up this, you know, why don't you try going around the corner and do this what looks to be an alternate way. And so that's what he did, and it turned out to be simple, just a simple walk up. So why that cairn was there, I don't know, but we got rid of the cairn because it was totally misleading.
Good for you. Yeah.
And we put another cairn on the descent. We put another cairn at the base of this obvious ramp, you know. So, and from there, it's a very easy, straightforward, you know, ascent up through the Torah Weep up to the summit of the colonnade. So it was another summit, and it was again smoky, and we didn't get that great view. So we actually were going to head south, and there's a smaller subsidiary southerly summit to the colonnade.
Oh.
And it's lower in elevation, so we were going to go out onto that because we'd heard that it has fantastic views from there down into Phantom Creek. And but given the late hour of the day plus the smoke, we just decided, you know, we got to get back to our packs. We still got a few hours to get back there, and probably 3 or 4 hours, something like that. So we just decided to turn around and call it quits at that point. And headed back to our pack. So that was kind of that was that trip in the fall. It went, you know, pretty uneventful. But for me, it was three new summits: Shiva Temple, Claude Bird's Eye, and the Colonnade.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just a fun fall experience. And again, having to rely on changing plans, mm-hmm. you know, and being able to have fallbacks. So. I think Art and I have particularly become adept at changing our plans and coming up with alternatives, because there's just so much to be done, right? And it's always there's always something else that you can easily fall back on if things go awry.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. That just sounds like just a wonderful hike.
It was, and you know, it was a relatively short one. I mean, in terms of overall, it was only a few nights, right, of camping out and then visiting the Bright Angel, the community there at the North Rim and in between. And but you know, you take what you can get in the canyon when you're coming from afar. And
right.
And I didn't, as time got past in my life, you know, I had few opportunities to get away for long periods of time. So when we first started doing these hikes together, Art and Bruce and I, you know, we were doing some 8-10 day trips or even longer. And you know, the opportunity to get away for that much time became more and more challenging for me as I had more career commitments and family commitments and things like that.
Right.
So it, you know, it was you kind of take advantage of whatever short opportunities you might have, right, as far as timing goes.
That's
and
right.
That year, I mean, we'd had the great trip in the spring. There's no question about that. So, but you can't always have the same level of length of trip and experience, right, that you have in your highlight trips. So
right.
It is still nonetheless very satisfying. So,
cool.
And, of course, the next trip we did in the spring of 2004 was another one of our Esplanade trips, and this was out west of Great Thumb Mesa. And this one again was essentially the last big trip we did on the Esplanade to the west of Great Thumb, and basically provided us with the full circuit of all the of the Thumb, as well as traversing of all the major mesas that are found on the Esplanade out there.
Okay.
Like Sinala Mesa, Matkat, you know, Chickapanagi, and Gatagama Terrace. And so this in the spring of 2004 was another long one. We definitely spent more time on this one than we had in the fall of 2003.
Did you do that with Art and Bruce then?
No, again, this was just Art.
Okay.
This one was just Art. So, Bruce, because of his work schedule, he was even more constrained than I. And
oh.
You know, he flies tours,
right.
Air tours,
right.
and does some training as well. And so, you know, he's got more serious commitments as far as work schedule. It's harder for him to get away for these lengths of time. So, And I think that a couple of times he just wasn't interested in the hike that we were planning, right? Which is
fair enough.
Fair enough for sure. Yeah, everybody has their own pursuit, right? And
yeah.
And you go where you want to go, and I can understand that. So
yeah.
It's always great when he is along, we will talk about some great trips that Bruce took with us subsequently, but he wasn't on these few. So,
right.
This trip into the Great Thumb area was another spectacular one, and this time wasn't changed by fire plans or anything like that. We basically followed through on what we planned to do, and so we drove up and drove Art's car out to Pasture Wash, and then farther along the road, heading out towards Great Thumb, Tobacoba Hilltop, and we got up onto the Great Thumb Road there, and as soon as you get up onto the road, heading out to the tip of the mesa, you get some spectacular views there, looking down into Forester Canyon, because the road goes right along the rim there. So,
right.
We kind of drove along there where it's relatively flat, past those views, and decided to park and camp at probably the last one before the road moves away from the rim.
Okay.
And so we set up our camp there, and Art parked his car a little bit off the road, and because that was going to be the jumping off point.
Do you remember the month?
Yeah, that was in April. It's April.
Okay.
April 30th is when we started, so the very end of April.
Okay.
And into May of 2004.
Just well after, sort of snow. You could get some sort of freak late season snow, but you've had all the winter rains come in, and so just thinking about water and what was going on there.
That's right. That was our plan. We had we'd had good luck with water out there on the Esplanade terraces, always in the spring, and so we were kind of assuming that we would probably be lucky in finding similar sources and seeps, on this year. So it was a reasonably good expectation. And we'd been through here before. You remember the first trip that Art and Bruce Grubbs and I did together as a team in 95, the first one where we all linked back up again after the time when I'd gone to grad school and moved to Canada and had, moved away from the canyon for quite some time. But we reconnected, and we did this trip, and we went out into Mat Katamiba and Olo Canyon area as a threesome. And so this was the same route to go into the canyon as we had taken in that 95 trip. And so it was kind of fun to revisit the first part of that. And 10 years later or whatever, something like that, 9 years, I guess.
Right.
And but it was just the two of us this time. So we left the car, and then we hiked out what's called the Telephone Trail, which is just a jeep trail that goes to the west off the high point of the Thumb. And it goes down to a point on the rim, Manicacha Point, I believe it is, where there used to be an old phone line that went down to Supai.
Right.
And so that's why they called this the telephone road and telephone line road. So we hiked on that, and of course it's all easy walking, and you could take jeeps on or 4x4s, but the walking is very pleasant, and it's all pretty much downhill, at a very gentle gradient. So we didn't mind the distance at all. And so that's about 5 or 6 miles, I guess, of hiking across the plateau until you get to the rim where the drop-off is. And we negotiated the drop, as we'd done in 95, and worked our way down to the Esplanade. And then
and there's a big spool. I remember this being there's a big cairn out there, a big spool of cable. Didn't they have quite the tower there, and a long run of cable down to the Esplanade below from there, isn't it?
Well, I don't doubt that, Tom, but I actually never hiked out to that point.
Okay.
To the end of that road. We've always, the couple times I've been out there, it was to go in as access into the Matkatamiba area.
Right.
And so so
you're bailing before the end of the road to head to the break down off the rim.
That's right. We actually walked the road about 3 miles, and the road looks like there's about 7 total. So,
got it. Okay.
It's quite a bit farther to get out to the point, but it'd be a great destination, for hiking out there. There's so many places to go if you had the opportunity, and of course it's much harder now to get up onto to Great Thumb,
right.
With the issues, I guess. I mean, our visit here was at this, after the new regulations had come in, and we were nervous at a certain level about leaving a car up there unprotected for 5 days, because you don't definitely know what's going to happen to it, but you just don't worry about these things too much. So, it would be a great destination to go out there and check that out. It sounds like you've been out there yourself.
A bit.
Yeah, okay. Going to have to interview you, Tom. I hope somebody's planning an oral interview for you.
Someday. The cobbler's
Someday,
shoes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got back down onto Matkatamiba, into the Matkatamiba drainage. Mm. And so the two of us...
what is that route like off the tip of the thumb?
You mean to get into Matkatamiba?
Yes.
Oh, it's very, very cool. You work your way down through the Kaibab. You go down a drainage first, right?
Okay.
You follow the Heidel land to the you're following the Heidel land after you leave the telephone road, and you cross a high point there. It's just a kind of a knob, and there's a benchmark called Elliott.
Okay.
And you continue following the Heidel land to the northwest, and eventually you come to the rim, and there's a drainage, two drainages parallel to the west of this rim point. And you work your way down the drainage that's the first one to the west, and it's just like walking, down a creek, a dry creek, with Kaibab shale chips in it and whatnot, and then eventually you hit the drop off.
Right.
And so at that point you have to work your way out and follow deer trails around the cliff edge to the east a few hundred meters.
Okay.
And maybe a quarter mile, and it's very airy. It's very open and steep, and you're right at the lip of the drop off, but it's a good little deer trail, of course, right? So as long as you don't stumble or something like that, you're not going to have any issues, right? But I can see where a lot of people would kind of freak out, because it's a deer trail on steep shale and above a big drop, right? And so and if it's wet, it's different, right? Because that stuff is all slippery and you can't necessarily trust it to maintain its integrity when you put your feet on it. So,
right.
But it was for us. It was just fine at this time, and you follow that around the lip until you get to the next break, and then at that point it's a fairly straightforward series of chimneys and gully drops to get down through the rest of the Kaibab and Toroweep, and then the Coconino is just a long talus slide. And I remember there's a very distinct, very sharp talus ridge that you have to walk down at one point. We did anyways, and just like this alluvium that was perched very, very delicately, and we just negotiated this. There was a little bit of a deer path that kind of walked between the big boulders of sandstone or limestone that were kind of cemented in this alluvial pile, and just really kind of exciting terrain to be traversing.
Cool.
But straightforward. Nothing problematic. Any Grand Canyon hiker would just really relish the ascent, just descent down that route, because it's just a typical classic,
Okay.
So at this point we were kind of on familiar ground. We had been here in the previous decade, and we'd seen horses in here,
right.
Evidence for the wild horses, and we knew where some water sources were. So we headed for this water source that we had camped at in 95, which is in I could show you on a map where it is, but it's a very prominent drainage that goes into Matkatamiva Canyon, and we had found a great pool there in 95 and camped there. So we knew that we were hoping to find that pool and be able to camp there again, but the pool was more of a seep this time. So, you know, that's interesting about the Esplanade is that things change from year to year.
Yeah.
Even if you have a good weather year, good weather winter, and you get a fair amount of precipitation, it doesn't necessarily mean that the same seeps and same springs are going to be active that you encountered last year, mm. right? So, but you have to assume and count on the fact that something else is going to pop up somewhere else.
And, that's right.
And that's typically what the way it is in the spring. The water's there if you look. Of course, this year, I don't know what it's been like down in the canyon particularly, but much of the West is experiencing a pretty major drought. So it could be that this year, if there wasn't much precipitation up there on the thumb, all these sources might have been dry in
That's
the spring.
Right.
So something to consider before you plan your trips, for sure. But we found a little bit of water at this seep, just enough to be able to fill our bottles, and then we continued out and headed to the saddle between Matkatamiba and Sinyala Canyon.
Okay.
So the Butte Fault crosses there, and as you know, we've talked about this fault system before. It transects across from Sinyala all the way over to. It crosses the river and goes up what they call Cranberry Canyon,
right?
Between Deer Creek and I guess it's Fishtail, and so we camped at the neck there between Sinyala and Matkatamiba.
Okay.
And again, our objective, as it has been in so many of our past hikes, was not so much to do the hike on the Esplanade as to do the day trips out to the points
right.
overlooking the river, you know, traversing out all these terraces that are just like magical walking. And so the first one we did started the next morning, and is Matkatamiba. And I remember walking out Matkatamiba, and at one point, just shortly after we left our campsite, this is with our day packs, right? So, because we're only going to be gone for half the day to do this
mm-hmm.
this morning traverse, and we just came down this little tiny drop in topography, and there's like a little miniature drainage in there, you know, kind of maybe I don't know 100 feet across, and you could see all of a sudden there was just glistening water everywhere, right?
Wow.
And it was just like it just was popping out of nowhere. I mean, there was nothing, there was no wow. topographic high behind this series of springs. It was just coming out there. It's like it was just really mystical that all this water would suddenly surface and just it was flowing across the shale and the sandstone slabs, and then it just as quickly disappeared, you know.
Huh.
But it just testified to the amount of water that exists out there at certain times of year and how it changes in where it pops up from year to year.
Yeah.
But that was just after leaving our packs. And we hiked out to the northeast end of Matkatamiba, where we had a tremendous view up the river, looking into 150-mile canyon, looking up the Colorado River and looking towards Matkatamiba.
Wow,
but we couldn't see Upset Rapids.
Okay.
I remember we could hear the roar of Upset Rapids below us, but we couldn't see down it directly enough to see the rapids themselves. And and from there, then we walked along the north side of Matkatamiba Mesa to the next viewpoint, which looked down onto the river about 2 miles upstream from Sinyala. And again, you could see great views down the river, and you could even see into Sinyala Canyon, but we couldn't see the mouth because it's too deep.
Right.
And you know, at this time of year, you're seeing river parties, down there on the water, and
Right.
it's pretty neat, you know, to be able to look down, and maybe we saw you, Tom. That's a possibility,
Who
you know.
knows?
That's right.
I wouldn't have, we wouldn't have known it.
No, we wouldn't have. We wouldn't have. So, but you know, we're just looking at the views. That's our objective, you know. And so we headed back along the mesa there, and lots of mezcal pits, I recall.
Right.
And we got back to our packs, and it was around midday, so we had our lunch there, and the plan was to continue to the southwest along the fault traverse. And into the next drainage, which is Sinyala. And so in that late afternoon, we did that. We moved our camp down. We took our backpacks and went down into Sinyala with the objective of going back up to the southwest onto the Sinyala Mesa and camping there. So, but when we got down to the bed of Sinyala, we decided to look for more water and see how far we could get downstream.
Okay.
We knew we couldn't go down to the river.
Right.
You know, and if you recall our earlier conversations of a number of weeks ago or months ago on that first trip that the three of us had been down into Mat Katamiba, we ran into Glenn Rink and Bob Hatcher, I think, and a couple of other people with them.
Right.
And they were coming up at that time up Mat Katamiba with ropes, and they then traversed over the fault valleys into Sinyala and then went down Sinyala with ropes and met their river party at the mouth of Sinyala. So we knew that there were big drops in Sinyala that, you know, precluded us from going down ourselves, but we thought we'd go as far as we could. And so we did go down and did a number of down climbs at, I remember some big chalkstone boulders that we had to down climb. And then we got to one that was about 40 feet in size.
With a pool of water at the bottom of it?
Well, yeah, at the bottom. I think we could see down. I mean, Art was looking down and he said if we had if we used our hand line, if we had a hand line, we could probably down climb this. And continue on from there. But we didn't go down at that point because we didn't have the hand line, I believe. I don't think we did at that on that trip.
Okay.
So that was, you know, that's as far as we got. But it sounds like you've got familiarity with that.
No, just doing the same thing. You come to this drop, and we were really thirsty at that point, and we looked over this lip, and it's a very uncomfortable drop, and there was a pool of water at the bottom of it, and we dropped this little can down there on a long string. And,
oh, neat.
And jiggered it around until the can sank, and then we pulled it up and did that multiple times back and forth just to get some water.
Yeah.
But you do get clipped out there without some decent rope and some rappel gear to keep heading on down. And that's where the canyoneering people are all into that. So that's
right,
cool.
Right. Yeah, well, you'll have to, on another occasion, you'll have to tell me when, you know, about your that trip into Sinyala. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'm just wondering how you got there, right? And but that we'll talk about that some other time. So, I remember we came back up and we had laid out nice water bottles. We had these like 2.5 liter water bottles.
Hmm.
And you lay them out in the sun, and they get nice and toasty, you know. And then, you take take the cap off. And Art had taken, you know, he gets a secondary cap, and he had drilled like 40 different little tiny drill holes into each of these caps. And then, so you exchange caps, and you hold the water bag up over your head, upside down, and the water comes out these little holes, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a shower.
Yeah.
And so we just strip down there in the sun, hold the water bottles over our heads, and just use it to just lather, you know, not lather up, but just rub the dirt off you, right?
Take
and just,
a bath.
It's so refreshing, right? And it's like it's so paradoxical because you're standing out in the middle of the desert. It's hot and there's very little water around, and you've got this luxury of a shower in the sunlight. So it's always a great experience to be able to shower off and clean up like that, right?
Yeah.
And so So we did that in the afternoon, and then moved our gear up to the camp at, on Sinala Mesa. So here was pretty neat, a neat place to be, because we had really fantastic views of Mount Sinala. I don't know if you've climbed that.
Yes, I'm asking. I'm waiting for the point to see if you walked around it and looked for the route.
Yeah, well, I haven't done it, and so the route that I'm familiar with is on the north side, just from reading about it. And we walked around that, not directly at the base of it, but farther out on the Esplanade, and it looked pretty steep. You know, it was not at all obvious.
Yeah.
I think it's a fairly straightforward climb, not too difficult, but a little loose. And it was not at all obvious to us. So I have it in my notes that it looked pretty impressive. So it's something to. I'd really like to get out there and do that someday, and I've got some ideas on how to do that. You know, there's the best way I think is in from Driftwood Canyon at this point, and so I got a plan to tackle that one.
Okay.
But it's still in the future. but we had a great day hike out onto Sinala Mesa.
Nice.
And out to the points. You know, again, just covering the distance, and again, you know. The numbers of mezcal pits out in these mesas is, it's really almost mind-boggling. I'm wondering if Bob Euler probably, you know, undertook an aerial survey of all these areas and probably counted these and identified as many of these as they could from the air.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're hiking out there, you just stumble upon them, you know, and another one here and another one there, and you really get the sense that they spent a lot of time the Anasazi visiting these sites and experiencing the joys of being out on the Esplanade, just like we were.
Yeah, so, just living there.
Just living there for sure.
Can you describe for me what one of these mezcal pits looks like?
Well, for sure. Yeah, just you know, it's. Sometimes they're not at all obvious, and sometimes they are. And basically, it's a large circular accumulation of rocks, typically limestone or sandstone, cobble-sized rocks, and typically it has a, you know, maybe it may be 15, 20 feet across or even larger,
and
a vertical relief of up to 3, maybe even 4 feet in some places, depending on the size of the mezcal pit. And in the center of the mezcal pit, there is a depression. So it's a kind of a circular depression. And you'll find a lot of charcoalized rocks in here and sometimes charcoalized wood in the center of the pit. And so this is where First Nations people would put their mezcal plants.
The agave.
And then they
hearts.
Would and then they would roast them.
Right.
And then so that would you know require them building a fire in there, which would then charcoalize the rocks and the wood debris that they presumably used to build the fire. And so there'd be all this roasting going on of the agave, and then presumably they would abandon that one and then go somewhere else. You know, I assume that they would harvest agave in a particular area and roast it up and then take it away and use it elsewhere or for a longer period of time. It's a good question. I hadn't actually thought through the details of this. I mean, how long did the agave last after it was roasted, and did they ever come back? And one gets the sense that they would revisit the same mezcal pits, but I'm guessing that probably they would have harvested the agave in the surrounding area and utilized all of it, and then they would go somewhere else where there was another crop of plants to be harvested and then use a mezcal pit there. So I don't really know how that would work, but in any event, there are hundreds and hundreds of these mezcal pits all over the Esplanade in that part of the world. and very, very impressive features. So we saw a lot on this trip, that's for sure. And so after our day trip there, our day hike, a few hours out and around Sinyala Mesa, we continued south, and the idea was that we were going to hike the Esplanade all the way to Lee Canyon. But when we came to the south, and we started feeling pretty light on, we were getting pretty light on water, and we realized that it was likely going to be dry. We had no definite water from as we passed Carbonate Canyon until we got down essentially to Topacoba. So we felt like the best thing to do was to drop down into Supai, and because we knew that there'd be definite water there, mm-hmm. and it would be a slam dunk. So it took us another about 2 days or a day and a half to get from Sinyala into Supai, but it's fairly straightforward walking, and there's a lot of horse trail in there. Right. But there's no water.
I mean, we had a hard time with water up there. Where did you find water?
Well, we had some at in the area of Sinyala.
Right.
We found some there in water pockets.
Right.
And then I don't recall any until we got down to Supai.
Right.
So we basically walked the Esplanade around Oglala Point and then Carbonate Canyon, and then there's horse trail here and there.
That's right.
I think there's an unnamed wash here that comes north out of Supai. I think they call it Schoolhouse Wash because an old schoolhouse is at the bottom of that. But anyways, we followed the Esplanade parallel to that and came to an overlook looking straight down on the village with this schoolhouse wash to our east.
Okay.
And look for a trail, a route down, and there's obvious ways to go. You could work your way down these cliffs, and there'd be a drop, and you could see trail coming up from below, you know.
Right.
But there was too much more of a drop than we wanted to deal with, so we'd have to poke around and find some other way. And eventually we found a very straightforward way to get down into the main canyon of the Supai village.
Mm-hmm.
And which was great because we finally had a good source of water. And I remember we stopped at the hotel there and kind of sat on the veranda. And this was in early May, right? And this is a popular time to be visiting Havasu.
Right.
And I just remember that here you got these two old guys, with long pants and long shirts with these big backpacks and filthy, and then you've got all the beautiful people out there, all the 20-year-olds running around in their tank tops and short shorts and flip-flops and experiencing, the delights of Havasu Canyon. And they truly are delights, right?
Mm.
But when you don't have to carry much gear down there and
you're
just coming in on the trails, it's you can have a lot more relaxing time, right? So we were quite the contrast to all the young folks. I say that kind of, tongue in cheek, because I was compared to today, I was 20 years younger than I am now, right? So but it was fun, fun place to be and to see the contrast, and it's kind of interesting when you're experiencing such solitude and wildness.
Yeah.
When you're up on the Esplanade, just a few miles away from
it's a bit of
mayhem.
A shock coming in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyways, I know the time's kind of getting late here, but we continued up Havasu Creek there, and we hiked up to the springs. And, I guess what we did was we tried to find the source of the springs. I had tried to do that many years before, the first time I'd been there, and Art had too. And both of us seem to recall at when we were down there in 2004 that when we had each been there independently 20 years earlier, the springs were on the south side, but this time they were They seem to be on the east side. So anyways, we still couldn't find the source of the water because it's just so dense in the reeds.
Heavy
you know, you've
vegetation.
Got all this
yeah.
Vegetation. It is just so thick to crash through. And of course, Havasu has a really good flow, so it's really hard to find the specific spot where it comes out. But anyways, we looked and mostly to stay in the cool, I think, and of the water and to splash around.
Yeah.
But we continued on up the creek then towards Lee Canyon, and we got to Lee Canyon, and it's kind of funny because the first tributary going up Lee Canyon that you pass on the right is called Rattlesnake Canyon, and we actually saw a rattlesnake there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, the first one of the trip, and which is kind of fun, you know. And we went on a little bit farther and camped for the night in a cool spot. So on the way out, you know, this is just the Lee Canyon Trail, is just fairly straightforward. That's an old roadway, actually,
right.
And that never made it, never was connected to
right.
the rim.
Right.
But we were going to go out that, and then we wanted to climb Mount Wodo, which is a Coconino Butte, Coconino with Torwe Butte.
How do you spell that? Is that
what's that?
L-O-D-O?
No, it's Wodo. W-O-D-O.
Thank you.
Mount Wodo. So it's about a mile and a half north of Lee Canyon.
Okay.
So it rises up off the Esplanade there.
Hmm.
And so we hiked up Lee Canyon about 2 miles and then dropped our packs. This would be the next morning, right? We camped somewhere up in the lower end of Lee Canyon. The next morning got up, hiked up about a mile, and then dropped our packs, and then headed to the northwest across the Esplanade, across a canyon called Putesoy, I think, P-U-T-E-S-O-I.
Okay.
And from there, it's a fairly straightforward hike up to the base of Mount Wodo. And we went up the south side, and it's one of these situations where you've got multiple choices of route, and you just have to kind of poke around and find the best chimney that you know that does get you through. And so we did that, and it was just, you know, fun climbing right kind of close to what you feel comfortable doing without a rope, knowing, you know, in places if you slip that it could be nasty, but you don't feel like you're going to slip, right? So
right.
it's no big deal. And then what happens to that route then is in the upper part of the Coconino, you get onto these really steep south-facing slabs of sandstone.
Huh.
And you're kind of walking up these slabs, and it's almost like you feel like every one of them is going to slide, you know. And just because it's quite steep. It's like 35, 40 degrees slope, something like that.
Huh.
But the slabs all managed to hold together, and eventually, you know, you work your way up through that, and then walk a little bit to the west, you get into the Torweep ledges there, and there's some climbing through Torweep, limey Torweep bands, cliffs, and eventually you're on the summit. So another gorgeous one, and these peaks out in the Western Grand Canyon are really spectacular for their distance views, right? From the top of Mount Wodo, you can see, you know, just great views out to the west, and I think you could actually see the dome from there. I don't quite recall, but I just remember just these tremendous views in all directions. So that's another reason why I want to get to Sinyala, because that's pretty much the ultimate one, to be in the middle of everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we got up Mount Wodo. That was another fine summit, and then worked our way back into Lee Canyon, and getting late in the day by this time. And of course, we take a lot of breaks, right? We like to sit in the shade and chew the fat and just relax and snooze and in the heat of the day. And I remember in Lee Canyon here, after we got back from Wodo, we were it's pretty open, and we had found some shade on the south side of the canyon, And we were just like right at the edge, you know, where if you had to push your back into the cliff to be out of the direct sun, you know, and because you're right at the edge of the shade, you could just feel the heat reflecting off the ground just a few feet away, right? But nonetheless, it's still better than being in the direct sun.
Right.
And so we kind of rested there for some time and until it cooled off. And then on our last night, we hiked a little bit farther up the canyon, decided to camp there. And I remember it was a breezy night, and I was kind of thinking, I think there's going to be bugs. So I asked Art if I could use his ArtLite tent. And because we're camped here on open slabs of sandstone, right? It's perfect camping for no tents. You just lay your ground cloth down, put your Therm-a-Rest mattress out, and then just have a great luxurious camp. But I felt like the bugs were going to be a problem, so I asked him if I could put up his tent, and I said I would sleep in it. He said fine, but he was going to sleep on the sandstone. So we settled in. And first thing, within a few minutes, I hear him just kind of frantically making these noises. And what's up? What's up? And he says he found a scorpion, like right next to his sleeping bag. So it was a little unnerving, but when you find these things at night, at least it is for me, you know. And I'm still the kind of guy that every morning I shake my hiking shoe out upside down because just want to make sure nothing's nestled in there overnight. But so Art finds this scorpion, and they're little brown ones, so you don't want to get bit by them, tan ones. And so it's a little bit of excitement. So then he says, oh, he settles back down, and a couple minutes go by, and there's another one, right? He finds another one of these scorpions just like inches from his head. And so that was it. He came in the tent with me. We zipped it up, and we didn't have any problems with scorpions the rest of the night. So, anyways, the end of the trip was kind of interesting because we hiked up the Topocoba Trail, and this is the first time I'd ever been up to Topocoba Hilltop. And I didn't realize that there's essentially two roads that were built up there. One, well, it was supposed to be one road, and it's a situation where a mining company, a development company, I think also some tourism interests involved in it, thought that they could build a road down into Lee Canyon and eventually, I guess, to Havasu. And so they started building the road from opposite ends, and we could see, it was very puzzling to us because we didn't know this story at the time. Art researched it afterwards, but we could see the trail we were on going up and heading towards the Coconino Cliff. And when I say it's a trail, I mean it's like a Jeep trail, right? It's a very well-constructed thing. And then we could see also a Jeep trail coming down from above at the top of the Coconino Cliff. And so we actually hypothesized that somebody, a mining operation or perhaps it was an early supply line for the village, had built a tramway there because these two road ends were obviously separated by like 200 feet of cliff, right? And Art did some research on this afterwards, and he found out, I think it was in that Quest for the Pillar of Gold volume, he found out that this venture had started building the road from two different directions, and they didn't really have a way to connect
Oh,
it.
gosh.
So, they spent like $75,000 on this operation in 1922 or something like that. And it was a boondoggle because there was really no way to connect it. And so eventually, this horse trail was built that does connect through the area, but you cannot get like a vehicle down it by any means. So it was kind of a great ending to a trip. I remember getting to the top of the Topocoba Trail there, and you're still down in the canyon a ways because the canyon of Lee Canyon has cut down through the Kaibab from the high parts of the rim. So you're in the Kaibab there, and the slopes are going up on either side of you, and there's pinyon here and pinyon there. And we found these old, really old vehicles, rusted out vehicles, and you know, from, it looked like they're from the 1920s or 30s, really, really old, old things. And just kind of interesting to see the history preserved, you know, in the in the area there. And so a great trip, a great ending. And
then you had to walk from there overland back to the car.
Yeah, so we basically walked up Lee Canyon on the trail there and then back to the road.
And then dropped your packs and just walk over and get the car and drive back?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, it was only a couple of miles back up, you know, back up the Great Thumb Road to get to the car. So we had, you know, we just dropped the packs and then did that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, cool. And that for us was kind of like, we had now done a circumnavigation of Great Thumb Mesa, right? And pretty much covered pretty much every terrace that's out there. Now, having said that, I would love to go back to any one of those places.
Yeah.
You know, they're just—it's such a fantastic place to go. And you know, when you walk out on these terraces, you've been out there hiking for 3 or 4 days, and you know, all you have are these distant views, and it's just splendid walking, wildflowers everywhere. And then you walk out on these terraces, and all of a sudden, there's a 3,000-foot drop.
Yeah.
You know, straight down to the Colorado River. It's just it's really an amazing place, you know, and so remote, right? It's really a delight to be out there and just feel like you're totally alone, you know, and you are. And yet, you know, people go there. You see occasional footprints, and we see hundreds of these mezcal pits, right?
Yeah.
That attest to the fact that people have been going there for thousands of years.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I would like to get back out there, and I kind of wish that it was that the regulations were more relaxed, right, with access to Great Thumb, but they are what they are, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's a good thing in a way because it kind of minimizes the amount of people that go out there.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and so it preserves that sense of isolation, right?
That's right.
And it's nice, too, that, you know, the trails in that part of the country are still, in that part of the canyon, are still deer trails as opposed to becoming, you know, overrun, deer trails that have become overrun by humans.
That's right. That's right.
And it always amazes me how quickly humans can trash a deer trail, you know?
Yeah.
These trails built by the animals are quite often very elegant and in the way that they negotiate the obstacles and find their way to the next break and then when you have, you know, a bunch of hikers coming through, they just kind of they're just looking for speed and they just kind of blast through and all those little details in the trail construction eventually disappear, right?
Things change.
So, things change, right?
So. Wonderful. Well, with that, maybe we'll put a comma in this interview series, and we'll pick up next time with what happened in the fall of 2004.
Yeah, okay.
All right. With that, this will conclude Part 18, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, July 18th, 2001. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure as always.